This interview with Alan Muhammad was recorded on March 27, 2021, during the Baltimore Youth Film Arts Workshop, Inside Stories, Perspectives on Incarceration.
I have 9 siblings, 5 girls, 4 boys. I'm the youngest of the boys. My father died when he was 7. I come out of a neighborhood called Murphy Homes, Lexington Terrace area. You know, and this area was infested with drugs, number writings, stick-up boys, whatever you want to call it. And I looked at, you know, for a father on the corner, my hero or my mentor or, you know, someone that I could look up to. And the corner became a surrogate dad to me, you know, because I made all the wrong choices. I didn't have anyone really blowing in my ear telling me not to do this or not to do that, you know. And we came up kind of poor, you know. I've learned that the word ghetto, when we talk about that, we make our communities ghetto, the ghetto. And my mother, she's 96 now, and she would always tell us, do the right thing, go to school, do the right thing, you know, send us to church and things like that, of that nature. Mm-hmm. But when I looked around and I saw all the guys that was on the corner making money, selling drugs and stuff like that, we was wearing a lot of hand-me-down clothes. And, you know, like I said, I chose the corner as a surrogate dad because my father passed away when I was 7. And I made a choice to say, okay, I want to be like this guy, that guy, and this guy. And, you know, you had the Little Malvins on the corner. You had Marvin Blockers. Like I said, my mother had to take care of 9 children, and she was doing the best she can, but it was never explained to me that, you know, okay, going to school and getting a job would be the best thing to do. You know, I didn't understand, you know, I didn't know how to distinguish from the two because I seen my mother struggling so hard, and it wasn't meeting the needs that we had. So when I looked at the guys on the corner that was bringing in so much money, I said, okay, let me do this and help my mother, you know. But I was still going to school. But when I came in and I had money in my pocket, my mother would say, where did this come from? And I told her, well, I was doing little work around the community. And she knew I was lying, you know, because it was too much money to have in my pocket. When I first started off, I was basically being used because I was a kid, you know. But the guys would give me a little couple hundred dollars, you know, take me and buy me clothes and tennis and stuff like that, you know, and send me on my way and tell me they'd meet me the next day. All I would do had to hold a stash for them, you know. But as things grew along, they would put me out there on the corner, you know, taking the drugs to the guy and stuff like that. You know, one time my mother friend came around the corner and she seen me serving a guy. And she told my mother, and my mother told me when I came in that day, she said, you know, you have 3 choices. You can go to school and finish school, get a job when you finish, or go to the military. Or, well, really 4 choices. She says, or get out my house, you know, leave my house. And I was 15, getting ready to turn 16 then. And she said, or leave my house. Because one time before, I went, my like I said, I had 3 brothers over top of me. My second to the oldest brother had our door kicked in before by selling drugs. And my mother said she wasn't having this again, you know. So she gave me the ultimatum of going to school, getting a job, finishing school, and going to military. So I thought I could pull the wool over our eyes and do it on the next corner. This particular time, she came from work. She was working at Maryland Cup Company at that time. She came and she saw me on the corner and she saw me serving someone. And it was crazy. You know, you're talking about having fear in your heart. My heart was in my mouth because I knew, you know, I had to expect something when I was going in. So when I went, I tried to make it the latest time to go in and thinking that she was sweet. When I got to the house, our house was right in front of 851 building. That's Murphy Homes, Al Street, that's Bennett Place. You know, so we had vestibules in our house. You had to open up one door to go through the other door. So when I got to the door, I opened up the door. I couldn't push the door too much because she had put my clothes and stuff in the vestibule behind the door. So she looked out the window and she told me, she said, you can put your key in the mailbox and take your SHIT out of my vestibule and get away from here. And mind you, I was ready to turn 16. I was doing good in school and everything. However, I had an old girlfriend live around the corner from me, fast and young. So I went to her house, and I explained to her what happened. So she said, well, look, I got to sneak you upstairs because my mother, I don't want to let my mother know that you're here. A couple weeks went by, and her mother was facing alcoholism and stuff like that, right? But she was a good woman, a real good woman. I take nothing from that. You know, I mean, we all have our problems. So she explained to her mother that, you know, I got put out of the house for some other reason, right? And that I would pay her to live there for a while. So what I would do is that I would buy her a drink, you know, to keep her boozed up, and I would give her $100 every other day, you know. So
yeah.
As time went on, you know, I got caught up by what we was calling then the knocks. You know, they caught me with some drugs in my pocket. I went to court, and they put me on probation. Scared, nervous from all the things that I heard about prison and stuff like that. It was definitely a wake-up call, but it was more, you know, I was nervous. I was scared. I really didn't know what to do. You know, I had all these things, these clothes and stuff in my hand that she had gave to me, and I couldn't carry them and things like that. You didn't have cell phones or stuff like that. You had beepers and stuff like that, and you would have to go to the phone booth and call who you was trying to reach. So I put in my beeper, one of my friends, to come help me with my stuff. I was nervous, and he was like, you know, my grandmother ain't gonna let you stay with me. So we got to find something to do. Again, this is like when I first started off, and I really wasn't making no money because I know I was being used. I was being used, you know. I told him, I said, well, let me go around to my girlfriend's house, and you watch my stuff, and let me see, can I finagle my way in of getting in? I was sure I was scared because I didn't have nowhere to go, nowhere else to turn. But I knew she was doing it, you know, for all the right reasons. But, you know, my mother was hard, and she was hard for a reason. So I was scared. I was nervous. And my friend wasn't letting me in his house either. So, yes, I was scared. My girlfriend, she had got me in there for a few days. One thing I didn't mention, her sister came and told her mother what was she doing. You know, why was she letting me in here? And she knew what I was doing and stuff like that. You know, and her mother said, well, it wasn't going to be that long, just for a few days. You know, he a good kid. He making mistakes. You know, so when the day did come for her to tell me to get out, I slept out on the streets. I went into, I was looking for somewhere to stay. I went into a Catholic church vestibule, and the priest came out and told me that I would have to leave. So I waited for a while, and I went into a funeral home, and I went to sleep inside of there till the next day. That's when I began to feel the rejection, you know, when nobody would let me in, you know. And I started explaining it to the guy that I was working for at this time was Marty and Onion. You may not know of them, but they was real big-time dudes at that time. Then down there with Malcolm Blocker, you know, I like Lil Malcolm Stringer, you know, a whole lot of these dudes, you know. So when I explained it to them, like, they were saying, well, like, we're going to give you enough money, sit you up in a hotel for a little while, you know. But I knew that wasn't going to last. And, yeah, I started feeling rejection then, you know. And I started, it opened my eyes that, you know, it made it seem like everybody was out for themselves, you know. So when I went back to my girlfriend, I told her I had something, you know, to do in terms of what I was doing. I was skimming off the bags then when I knew they was using me, making up my own little bag so I could get enough money to try to get me and my girlfriend an apartment. My second oldest brother, he was already incarcerated with a 12-year sentence. So my brother that was over top of me, he was about ready to graduate from Edison High School. And he would always, you know, tell me, come on, man, do what you gotta do. You know, mom's struggling. You know, he said, go ahead and finish school and, do what I'm getting ready to do. He joined the Navy, you know, and, he used to always try to tell me, you know, come on, man, do what I, and I used to say to him, man, mom's struggling. She don't know I'm really trying to help her. He used to always say, that's bull. I don't want to cuss. That's bull S. Mm-hmm, he said, mm-hmm. You out there on your, you know, helping yourself. He said, because if you was really trying to help your mother, you'll do what you're supposed to do. You know, our mother, you know, and I used to say, well, you know, are you bringing in the money that I'm bringing in? And my mother used to tell me, don't bring that dirty money in my house. You know, don't come in here with that money. I don't want none. You know, so I used to always have an excuse to my brother on why, you know, I was doing what I was doing. You know, even my sisters try to, you know, get me to do the right thing. You know, but I made a promise to my mother that I would finish school. So I went to Harvard City and I got my GED, you know, and she felt proud of me and she asked me, well, you got that. Why don't you try to go to military or something like that? It was in my mind, but the money was, you know, it started coming in by me skimming off the top of these bags that I was getting from the guy. The money had started coming in then, you know, the money was looking too good to me. And then, you know, it was glitter. It was gold. And this was making who I was, my personality. Absolutely. You're absolutely right. You know, I knew it would be a big threat to my life if I got caught. You know, so what I would do is this, you know, the heroin that they were selling then, you know, you had different grades of heroin. And what I was holding then, it was called mud, you know. So when you put it in the cooker and shoot it up, it would turn brown. So what I would do, I would take a little bit of cut and a little bit of nutmeg, and I would always mix it together and put it back into the bags that I was having, you know. And long as they wasn't getting too many complaints about whether the heroin was good or bad, I felt like I was all right, you know. But I knew that if I got caught, that I would be in danger, would be a threat to me. When I felt that sense of rejection, you know, in my mind, I said, okay, they rejected me. I don't care. You know, I don't care. So I started doing that because I felt rejected. First, I felt, you know, I felt like by me not having a father and with other fathers, the guys that could turn to their father and stuff like that, and me not understanding what death meant, you know, I felt like that people was doing me wrong, my family did me wrong, you know, my father seemed like, you know, he had left on us when he needed us, when we needed him, and stuff like that. So, you know, it felt real hard to me. I felt heartbroken because I didn't have a father. And I told myself, okay, that I, when I have children, that I'm going to be a better father, you know. And I'm just selling myself games and lies and all of that because being a better father, I would have been doing what my mother told me to do, you know. But I chose the corner. Like I said, the corner became a surrogate dad for me. My dad came off the corner because I looked up to these people on the corner, you know, and I started making choices and distinctions from who I wanted to be, you know, on that corner. I wanted to be Little Malcolm at one time. I wanted to be Slim Charles at another time. You know, then I wanted to be Marvin Blocker at another time. You know, so it felt kind of strange, but I felt like I was doing the right thing to be a father, you know, even though, you know, deep down inside, I knew I wasn't, you know, because I, you know, my mother had told me that she didn't want no dirty money. The lady that, she's deceased now, that mother's deceased. She died of lupus about 7 years ago. While I was in prison, she used to always tell them that you had a good father because he was providing for us. Even though he did it the wrong way, you had a good father. You know, he would go out his way to make money when, you know, I should have been in a job. But she said she would always tell them that. So I came home. I've been home now about 6 years. I had a 50-year sentence. I did 30 years in prison straight. I caught this sentence when I was getting ready to turn 20 years old. You know, so basically my whole childhood, you know, was I gave it away. I gave it away, you know, to the plantation. But she was pregnant with my last daughter when I first got incarcerated. And she was kind of scared to tell me that she was pregnant. And when she came over to jail, she came over there with my sister to visit me, you know. And we was talking, and then she popped up and said, well, you know I'm pregnant. And this was like 3 months of me and waiting to go to court. And I said, what? You know, and back then, you know, you thinking kind of crazy. I said, who was by? She said, it's yours. I said, oh, it's mine. It's not been in here for 3 months. You know, I say, if, you know, you was pregnant, you should have been told me. I said, yeah, you better go get a blood test, you know, and it made her cry, you know, and my sister slapped me, you know, because she knew the relationship that we had. It was so cohesive. It was so tight, you know, that she wouldn't step out on me like that. But my mentality wouldn't allow me to understand that, you know, and they told me they couldn't give me a blood test of the baby until it was born, you know, but in between all of that, she explained to them that I was a good father, you know. And when I came home, we have a great relationship. Well, I say I thank God. Well, I have two incarcerations. My first incarceration was I had caught a 6-year sentence. I did 2 years on that sentence. Going in, before you go to prison, you hear a lot of things about prison. You know, guys getting raped, you know, being used, getting hung, and stuff like that, you know. So I was nervous. My heart was more than in my mouth. It was every, you know, seemed like my heart had bust. And if I said something or move, you could see me shaking. This how, you know, scared I was going in the incarceration. And when I first went in, on my first sentence, they had waved on me. They waved on me. I did a shooting because this guy had a sister stabbed my sister in the neck. So I had a gun in my bag and I shot at him. And when I went to court, you know, the judge told me I took the law in my own hands and he sent me to 6 years. When I first went in, you had to go through the Maryland Penitentiary, and you was in there with them guys, and the way they did distinguish you, they gave us white jumpsuits while they wore their regular clothes, you know. And all the stuff that they talked about that is scary in prison, it was there right in your face. You know, friends tricking friends, people being raped, you know, guys hanging themselves, you know, you get as much drugs in there. And it's some of the best drugs in prison than you do on the streets. You know, guys buying drugs, can't pay it back. And you may see that guy stab that guy for not being able to pay it back. You know, so I was so frightened, you know, that, you know, and phones wasn't in the prison system. Then you had to ask your counselor, to ask the captain, could you come up to the office and make a call? I was so scared. I was trying to get up to the counselor's office every day to make a call, to call my mom to tell her, get me a lawyer to get me out of here. I won't do it again. I won't do it again. You know, and all this type of stuff. Deep down in my heart, I was lying. But I did 2 years on it. And it made me grow bitter. I got bitter because I felt like I was doing the right thing by protecting myself. And I thought the judge did the wrong thing by giving me this time. So I grew bitter. And in prison, you know, it kind of like, you know, you got to fall in line because it's a world, a different world inside of a world. The rules become different than it is on the street. You know, if you grew up with someone that used to sleep in your own bed, you know, like your friend or your neighbor, you know, sometimes they become your worst enemy, you know, because they sell you out, you know, to the dude that might be selling drugs or letting out Debbie's or selling cigarettes in the institution at that time they was allowing cigarettes in. So, you know, you had to learn real quick. And when like I said, they waved on me. Me being a boy, yeah, it went away. I knew then I had to become a man, you know, because I had no help. You know, you had, like I said, I knew people in prison from off the street. And when I went to him and asked him, you know, how to deal with this, the first thing he did was give me two shanks, two knives. And he said, handle your business if something happened. That made me even more nervous because now I knew that I would probably have to stab someone in prison if something happened. And if you didn't handle your business in prison, you know, then, you know, guys would try your hand, you know, to molest you or to rape you. You know, so when I went through that experience, I was so grateful to God to get out of it. You know, once I did the 2 years, they had sent me up Hagerstown. You know, like I said, penitentiary was a transitional spot when you first went in. And I did the 2 years up Hagerstown, came home. But deep down inside, I was bitter with the system. I was angry with the system. I was angry with society. And I tried to go to the military to say I wanted to change my life. By me having this strike on my record, back then, you know, people was checking your record to give you a job and all that. And when I went to the military, I went to the place to go to the military, he told me I had to get this stuff expunged off my record. And I'm like, get expunged? How the hell I do that? Because I didn't know what it was. You know, when I asked a lot of people to do that, you know, I said that, man, I got to go through so many channels to do this stuff. Hell with that, you know. So I went to try to get a job. And they asked me about have I ever been incarcerated, stuff like that. And a lot of people turned me down. And it made me turn back to the streets. Like I said, I was bitter. And back then, you know, if you explain your feelings to someone, it made you look weak. You know, you didn't want to know, you didn't want a lot of people to know how you was feeling inside. You know, so you had to put a facade on, a different face on, to be, you know, somebody that you wasn't. We have a close-knit family. And we're real supportive of each other no matter what we do. You know, we have each other's back. You know, and they wanted to, you know, really find out what was going on and what would happen to me. And, you know, my mother was crying. My sister was crying. And, you know, my brother was there just shaking his head. And like I said, I had already had a brother incarcerated with 12 years, you know, and I felt like that, I got to go through this. I'm going to be all right. You know, I'm going to be okay. You know, I just got to find out where he was at. But that wasn't the case, you know. And my mom, you know, they swear, they say, well, look, we want to take care of you. We're going to keep your account full, and we're going to try to get you another lawyer to get you out of here. You know, it was a relief hand there, but it really didn't resolve anything what I was feeling on the inside, because I knew that I was getting ready to go in a place that I heard all these bad horror stories about, you know. So, yeah, they was there for me. Absolutely. Because, you know, a lot of my other friends had went to prison, and when we talk about it, they talk about, you know, how friends and family drops off. You know, they'd be there, you know, for one minute, and then as years go along, you begin to see people drop off, you know, not being there like they used to be, you know, giving you excuses on why they can't accept your calls no more and things of that nature, right? So absolutely, I felt that, you know, okay, how long this will last? You know, are they going to stay there with me till the end of my sentence, or, you know, are they going to let me go and, you know, during some time of my sentence? So, yes, I felt that way. You're at your most vulnerable moments when you're in prison, you know, because you have no type of recourse in prison where you can turn and go somewhere and be by yourself and think and gather yourself together. You know, you're in prison, you have a cell buddy unless you're on an honor tier, and you may go up and get a single cell. But, no, most of my depression, my stress, my nerves and stuff were in prison, you know, because I had nowhere to turn, I had nowhere to go. And every day you get up, you're in the same place, with the same people, and then you with officers, and some officers don't care when you're going through a situation. You know, they allow that to happen to you, and then they'll call the squad, what we used to call the boom squad, to come in to stop the fight. You may be dead during that time, you know, depending on what the situation was. So, no, absolutely no, I never felt safer in prison. It's a psychological effect that I still experience. My wife asked me sometimes, you know, why you go down to the kitchen and sit in there with you for yourself a half an hour to an hour, you know, almost every night. And it's a psychological effect that I suffered while I was incarcerated. You know, you're in this 9x8 box every day. You're in there with another guy. you know, and excuse my terms, when he defecates, you smelling it, you know, these things affect you. When you eat, you be eating what someone else chose for you to eat every day, particularly if you don't have money for commissary. You know, you eat every day what somebody tell you. You have to get in the shower when they tell you you can get in the shower. You can't get on the phone unless they allow you to get on the phone. Yes, these things are psychological effects, and they stay with you. They stay with you for a lifetime, you know. And you have to, you know, really get and talk to yourself, you know, to find some type of medium, you know, to try to balance these things out. You know, and the thing that I do, you know, maybe 2 to 3 times out of a week, I go down to my kitchen, and it's quiet, and I sit in there, and I think to myself, and I talk to my Lord, you know, of getting me through my experience or what I went through. I smell it, I feel it, I even do some of the things that, you know, unexpected to myself that I used to do while I was incarcerated. Let me give you one experience. In Shal, me being Muslim, we call it a wrap that we wear around. We don't expose our Lord and our body, you know, like our privacies and stuff like that. So
yeah,
we wear a wrap. Sometimes I catch myself getting in the shower in here with that wrap on, you know, opposed to going in there, you know, fully nude and stuff.
Yes.
My lady friend would say, you know, why are you in there? I mean, my wife, I'm sorry. She would say, why are you in there with that wrap on? And I think to myself, you're right, why am I in here with this wrap on? And then even when we're eating, you know, when we're eating, I eat my food so fast. She'll say, slow down. Why are you eating like that? Slow down. You know, because you want a timer in prison to eat your food. She'll say, slow down. Slow down. Why you ain't got to eat like that no more? Slow down. Exactly. Unconsciously, it became a part of my life, and it's still there. You got to, you know, these things got to be weaved out. And they got to be weaved out real slow, because sometimes you fall, you know, in the wrong places of these things. Mm-hmm. I had, when I first came home, I went to social service, and I was getting a couple of dials every month in food stamps and stuff like that. And I asked them, you know, could I get some Medicare benefits and stuff like that? And when they told me yes, and I asked them, well, do they know a good place where I could see a therapist at? And they sent me to this place, a wonderful lady, Caucasian woman, wonderful, come from Chicago. She was older. And we used to sit down and we used to talk and meditate. And she would give me certain exercises to do. But, you know, she, you know, sorry to hear, she had to go back to Chicago because her mother wasn't doing that good. And she was an elderly woman herself. So I understood, but it made me cry because we got so close together, and she understood where I was coming from, and she put in extra time in terms of being involved in my life to help me try to work through some of the things that were still affecting me psychologically. So yes, I did, but when she left, kind of like I say, you fall into some of the wrong places when you try to do these things. I felt a little rejection then, that little rejection stuff came back again, because I didn't want to be transferred to a new person and then start my story all over. So it was my fault to not follow up on that, you know, and I should have. My second incarceration, I had caught a 50-year sentence. My charge was second-degree murder. They gave me 30 years for the murder and 20 years for the gun. This is when, I had turned 19 and I went in while, my wife at that time was pregnant with my last child. But, to get into what you were saying, I went to, institution called Patuxent Institution. And, during that time, they had counselors, therapists, the whole nine yards of trying to help you out. We would have a counseling session 3 to 4 times a week in terms of what led you up to your incarceration, what made you choose a life of crime over, you know, doing something right. You know, so we would definitely get into the meat of why we was there, but at the same time, they had shop programs that you could go to work in, you know, shops they was offering. They also had college, where college professors was coming in, and you take college courses. At this time, I chose to get my barber's license. They was allowing you to get your barber's license, your electrician license, and things of that nature. I chose to get my barber's license, which I did. You know, I achieved that. And I cut the officers. Hey, I worked in the officer's barber shop. Depending on how good you was, you know, they'd send you to the shop, and how, you know, your adjustment record was in while you was incarcerated, like getting in the fights, stabbings, and things of that nature, right? So I was doing pretty good. Then they put me in the officer's barber shop. I would cut the warden hair. I would cut the director hair. I was cutting some of the women hair, stuff like that while I was in there. It opened up the door. I'm glad you said it. It opened up the door for me while I was in there, because I was being trusted by a lot of people. And we came up, a couple guys and us, we came up, you know, like I said, they had all different type of programs and stuff. But we came up with an idea, you know, to start a project for first-time incarceration youth that was coming into prison. And I dropped the idea on the warden while I was cutting his hair one day. And I told him that, you know, a group of us would like to start a program in the course while we're here, to talk to the first-time youth offenders that's coming in here. Because, you know, like I said, I was nervous. I was scared. People was tricking you when you went in there. People was raping you and molesting you and things of that nature. And this stuff was still going on. And I explained that to the warden that, you know, see, these guys come in here with nothing, and they ask the bar things, not understanding, you know, the rules and regulations of this different world, you know, of being in a different world other than being outside in another world, you know. And a lot of times they would fall in the trap. So they allow us to start, you know, this Youth Act program while we was in there. You know, I started a new job. Once I got out of that, I went to this other job called MCI program. Is like where you make the most money in the program, you know. And but we was printing up license stickers, yearly stickers and stuff like that, to go on to cars and stuff like that for motor vehicle, you know, getting contracts. So we was doing that, and I learned to do that. One of the things I learned is how to run a printing press. You know, it's called the ABJ printing press and stuff like that. So I learned to do that with that, you know. So you have to choose and decide what you want to do with your time. You have to sit back and ask yourself, you know, do you want to further go down the rabbit hole, or do you want to change, you know, your way of life, you know. And it's real hard to do that, because I say, like, you're in a different world and there's so much going on around you, and your mentality change, you know, while you're there. You know, so I made the choice, you know, to try to say, I'm going to do something with my life, because I don't even know if I'm going to make it home or not with a 50-year sentence. You know, it's like having a life debt. It makes you feel good. It's more than making you feel good, because first, let me get back to this, and I don't want to be redundant. I'm Muslim, you know, and it gives you a different perspective on how to look at life. You know, and how to look at another human being, whether you're Muslim, Jew, Christian, whatever, you know, atheist, whatever. It gives you a different perspective to look at life and how to respect it, you know. So what you say, you have to be that. You couldn't just say something to somebody in there and not allow it to be your character. So it made me feel good that the things that I was saying to the guys that was coming in, you know, that some of them was older than me, some of them wasn't older than me. You know, it made me feel good to say the things that I had, that I was saying to him, because I had to be what I was saying. You know, my model had to be that inside of the jail. You know, when we stepped out of this room and going back into, you know, the jail system, you know, you have to be that. And them guys looked at you real close, you know, and they drew it closer to you because they felt a sense of protection that everybody looked for when you go in there. You know, even the strongest guys, like when I talk about Little Melvin, you know, Sim Charles, Stakeham, and stuff like that, you know, even the guys from The Wire, they're my closest friends, Chris Warren and all of them, Bodie, all of them, they're my closest friends. These are guys I come up with, you know. Even us, we cry, you know. We feel a sense of abandonment, you know. We feel like, you know, we left alone and there's nobody there for us, you know. So you have to, you know, pull yourself together and you have to make a serious decision. Now, I didn't make this decision when I first went in there. You know, I still had a street mentality. It was, to me, it was kill or be killed, you know. Do what you had to do. You have to be there first, you know, to find out, you know, how do I deal with this world in here? How do I deal with all these ills that I heard about what's going on in here? You know what I mean? And again, I seen guys trick dudes out of their butt. I seen dudes trick, and some of them was the best of friends. You know, I even seen a dude, I heard a dude, and he was talking about paying off his bill. He said he had another court to go through. He had already had a 30-year sentence. It was a white guy. And he said he don't think he can handle another, you know, some more time. And it was a commissary day. And everybody was going up to the chow when he was coming back from commissary. He said, I'm going to pay all y'all off that I owe y'all. He said, y'all can take this right here. He said, the rest of y'all, when y'all come back, they'll be in my cell. Now, his cell was next door to me. And again, I worked in the MCI shop. So that's the best job you can get in the system. I came down to go to commissary just to put my stuff in my cell and then go back to work. So I didn't go to chow that day. So I heard something, and I had made my salat because my prayer came in. But I heard something kicking on the wall real hard, kicking on the wall real, real hard and stuff. I knocked on the wall, right? And I said, boy, you all right over there? And it wouldn't, never said nothing. So when they came back from chow, He had hung himself. You open up all the doors when you come back from chow, but you got to get in your cell. And I stepped out there to look at him and make sure he was all right, but he had hung himself. You know, and it messed me up real bad, you know, because that wasn't the first hanging I saw, but he was actually a good dude, you know. I mean, we made mistakes, stuff like that, you know, but he was actually a good dude. No, that wasn't the only hanging I saw. I saw a lot. You know, being in prison for 30 years, you see a lot. I'm going to give you two, and I'm going to try to make it as brief as possible. I'm going to give you two of the experiences that I saw. Well, I'm going to give you three, and I'm going to make them real brief. Young guy, younger than me at the time, I had grown a little older then. I probably was in my mid-20s, maybe late 20s, was on the phone talking to this young lady, telling her that, you know, don't leave, hold on. You know, I got a kid, but you say I'm going back to court. He said, and the judge talking about taking most of my time back. That means I would only have to do a year. You can hear him because he's talking real loud. And at this time, they had put phones on the tiers. And he was talking real loud and stuff like that. And he was like, don't leave me, and started crying. And and stuff like that. And the officer, you know, told him he had to hold it down because he was loud and talking to his girl. So she must have hung up on him because he kept saying, you dead. And he tried to call back and she wouldn't accept the call. He asked the officer to let him lock in and stuff. And he went and locked in. And about a half an hour, maybe to an hour later, you know, the tier he was on was a traffic tier. And what that means, you had to come through his tier to get to other tiers, mm-hmm. You know. And one of his friends was coming up through the tier to go to his cell. to go to his chair, looked in his cell, and he had hung himself. He was hanging from the bars, and when the officer opened up the grill, everybody ran down to his cell, you know, and they were telling the officer, open the door so we can grab and try to put him up to see if he was still living. Mm-hmm. But the officer, you can't do that. You got to leave the scene exactly the way it is, you know. And the officer wouldn't open the door. He wouldn't even go in there and do it until the warden came up and nurses from the infirmary came up. So we felt that sense of betrayal, knowing that the system didn't have our best interests at heart. When gangs started getting popular in the jail, this guy, his family was real supportive of him. So, and we get packages. We had package months and all that type of stuff. You know, and this guy, he would take certain guys and say, let me get a package in your name that wasn't getting packaged. He said, I'll get my mother to buy you a couple pair of jeans, and I'll get my mother to buy you some tennis, you know, because he wanted to get it, have a lot of clothes. Mm-hmm. So this particular dude, I knew the dude too, come out of Lexington Terrace. You know, he was in the gang, Black Gorilla, whatever they call him. What's the name?
Family.
Exactly.
BFG, Black Gorilla Family.
That's right, exactly. Mm-hmm. And they went to him to lean on him, tell him, say, look, get us some of this. And he told me, he said, man, you must be crazy. I'm not getting you anything. He said, all right. I said, I'm not, scared of that. So we went in the yard that evening. And in jail, you can tell when something can happen because you feel that all around you. So you know it. You know, you feel that vibe going around you. And everybody back is to the wall. You know, so I walk out in the yard. And one of the guys say, I used to like to run the yard. He used to say, Basim, hold on, man. He said, something great happened. And lo and behold, while I can turn around, you can hear a bat cracking. The dude hit the dude with the bat in the head and cracked his skull. Mm-hmm. He died. They sent in an ambulance to lift him up out of there, but the guy died. We had to go in this place called the Annex, so they moved a lot of us off the tier because asbestos was all through the tier, and the fungus and stuff was falling up the wall. So while they was working on it and closed down the tier, they sent us in this place called the Annex. It's like a dorm. Mm-hmm. You got three parts to this dorm. You know, so we had one tier in this dorm, one tier in that dorm, one tier. And you can interact with each other and stuff like that. There's a guy I know that come out of Murphy Homes, and another guy that came out of another part of Murphy Homes was there. And the older guy, and the guy was real small. He was leaning on the younger guy. He was always take his commissary, always go through his packages and stuff like that. And the younger guy would always report to the officers what the guy was doing, and he wanted to be moved from the tier. Or moved out of jail. And they were just discounted and throw it away and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So when they moved us down in the Annex, and they had a gym period, and a guy told him, and it was a commissary day, and he told me, when I come back, excuse my language, he said, my commissary shit better be on my bed. The young guy said, I'm tired of this, man. I'm not going to allow you to do this to me anymore. This is the last time. I'm not doing this. I'm not doing it. So on the way, when they came back from gym, we get like an hour and maybe 20 minutes to a half an hour in gym. Mm-hmm. When they came back from gym, he come in there, he called himself being bad. He walked straight to the young guy. And the young guy pulled out an ice pick and stuffed him right in his chest. And he left it in his chest. And the dude grabbed his chest and turned around. And officers sit up in the station, we call it the bubble. He tried to walk to the bubble, and before he got to the bubble, he fell. And that's where he died. A lot of stuff in prison, yeah, you see. It's psychologically, yes, infection. And you have to you have to mold your life around that, because you don't never know when it's going to be someone to challenge you. One thing my mother told me when she put me out, right, she used to always, still be there for me, but she told me, if you ever think you bad, because of someone badder than you. And they will always challenge you because they want to be the most bad one. She said, but always be serious and a man of your word. And I stuck with that. It stuck with me to the day. I'm a serious brother, and I take things real serious. And I try to be a man of my word, and if things change, I go to the person and say, look, I have to do something else. This is what happened. Now, can you bear with me? Or let's just, you know, resolve the issue. You know, and I remember that. And it makes me a better man. Having a strike against you, you know, it always fall in a place where opportunities are lacking, and you're not, you know, given the, you know, the best of the choices that come a person's way. But you have to realize that you put yourself in this position, and you have to make something happen for yourself. You know, society, to me, in a lot of ways, haven't gotten better. It got some ways worse than it was when I went into society because, you know, you did, like, you know, Brother Greg said, you had a moral compass out here on the streets when I went in. You know, men would be men, and they would stick, you know, they lived it by principles and standards and stuff like that. You know, today, youth doesn't live by certain standards or morals and stuff like that. Even when you go into going into a company or a corporation and trying to get a job, you know, when I first came home, I went to this welding company, and my credentials was better than the guy that was before me and after me. And when I went into an interview, she asked me, was I ever incarcerated? I started to lie because I know there's a window that you have from 5 to 7 years that they can ask you about your incarceration or put on your application. And I didn't put it on there. And when she went down the application, she asked me, you know, was you ever incarcerated? And I paused. And I was asking myself in my mind, you know, should I tell her the truth or should I lie? You know, and I said, I'm going to tell her the truth because this would be the best way of me getting something, you know, with my belief in God and everything and stuff like that. So I told her, I said, yes, I was incarcerated before. I said, but it had been a long time ago. It was a while ago. I said, it was back in 1985. I said, I haven't been to prison since then. And then she said, would you mind expounding on what you was incarcerated for? And it I kind of knew then, right then and there, that I was going to be scratched from this list, right? And I told her, I said, is that a requirement? Do I have to do it? She said, no, you don't have to do it. She said, but I prefer you do it. Okay, I told her, I said, okay, well, I was young. I said, I come out of a drug-ridden area. Some of us would call it private ghetto and things of that nature. I said, but it was you know, an area where you grew up and you had to make certain choices. I said, when I was young, I made the wrong choice. I said, I got in a situation where some guys kind of tried to rob me, and I had a gun on me. And I shot one of the guys, and he died. And she said, all right, I don't need to hear no more. But I knew right then and there that society wasn't going to play fair with me. You know, and that I would have to make my own way. But I had to understand, too, on the other side of that coin, no one did this to me but me. You know, so I had to find some way to keep trying to put this bitterness that I had with society about me being incarceration in a place where it wouldn't affect me of doing what I needed to be done. You know. So, yeah, no. I think society played fair. Yes, sometimes it does. Yes, I appreciate that. I appreciate that, Anna. And you know, it was a blessing to me. You know, and just to piggyback from what you said, right, in terms of strength, a lot of people say to me, right, Fasine, that's what most of my, they say, Fasine, tell me the truth. You did 30 years straight. I say, yeah. They say, man, you're not demented. You're not crazy. Nothing like that. So I said, I'm blessed by God. I say, so, if you call that crazy, then I'm crazy. I said, but no, I'm not crazy. Do I have my moments of psychological effects? I said, yeah, I had them. I said, but everybody has them. You know, I said, but I'm not crazy. I trusted God while I was there, and God brought me through. But when I went to prison, you know, I had a prison experience where I went to a Christian meeting, and they was talking about other religious groups on how, you know, if you don't accept Christ, you're going to hell, and you and they this and they that, you know, some of them are nationalists and all. And I said to them, this is before I caught my 50-year sentence, I say, why are we talking about other groups? Let's talk about what God can do for us. Because I'm scared, because I went in there, my papers, they give you a true bill when you have a murder. Had first degree on there, murder. You don't get the rest of the degrees until you go into court. You know, like first degree, second degree manslaughter, something like that, or not guilty. You know, so I said, why do we keep talking about these people? Let's talk about what God's going to do for us and what we need to do to change. I don't want to hear that. And the outside coordinator and the head of the group say, well, if you don't want to hear this, you can leave. Right? And I left. And I had already knew two older guys that was in Islam. Asked me, well, I thought you was at your meeting. I said, nah, I just went through something, you know, stuff like that. So they said, well, you're welcome to come to a Talim service, which is a speaking gathering when you go to the Muslim thing. And it made me open my heart to look at other religions. And I seen Islam, I found Islam was the best thing for me. You know, it opened my mind. You know, it gave me a different perspective about people and the world, you know. And it just went from there, you know, just went from there. But I try not to push it on other people because they are who they are, regardless of what it is. You know, I just, you know, leave it to me. And when somebody asks me, then I explain it to them. I would love to do this again whenever you need me. I would love to give back because there's so much to what I have to say in terms of me, that transition from being my first incarceration into my second, you know, and the things that affected me in terms of my second incarceration. So I would love to do this again because I feel like I'm giving back. One day, and I told him that a group of us would like to start a program in the course while we're here to talk to the first time youth offenders that's coming here, because you know, like I said, I was nervous, I was scared. People was tricking you when you went in there. People was raping you and molesting you and things of that nature, and this stuff was still going on. And I explained that to the warden that you know these guys coming here with nothing. And they ask to bar things, not understanding, you know, the rules and regulations of this different world. You know, of being in a different world other than being outside in another world, you know. And a lot of times they would fall in the trap. So they allow us to start, you know, this youth act program that while we was in there. You know, I started a new job. Once I got out of that, I went into this other job called MCI program. It's like where you make the most money in the program, you know. And but we was printing up license stickers, yearly stickers and stuff like that to go on to cars and stuff like that for motor vehicle, you know, getting contracts. So we was doing that. And I learned to do that. One of the things I learned is how to run a printing press. You know, it's called an ABJ printing press and stuff like that. So I learned to do that with that. You know, so you have to choose and decide what you want to do with your time. You have to sit back and ask yourself, you know, do you want to further go down the rabbit hole or do you want to change, you know, your way of life, you know? And it's real hard to do that because I say, like you're in a different world and there's so much going on around you and your mentality change, you know, while you're there, you know. So I made the choice, you know, to try to say, I'm going to do something with my life because I don't even know if I'm going to make it home or not with a 50-year sentence. You know, it's like having a life debt. It makes you feel good. It's more than making you feel good because first, let me get back to this. And I don't want to be redundant. I'm Muslim. You know, and it gives you a different perspective on how to look at life, you know, and how to look at another human being, whether you Muslim, Jew, Christian, whatever, you know, atheist, whatever. It gives you a different perspective to look at life and how to respect it, you know. So what you say, you have to be that. You couldn't just say something to somebody in there and not allow it to be your character. So it made me feel good that the things that I was saying to the guys that was coming in, you know, that some of them was older than me, some of them wasn't older than me, you know, it made me feel good to say the things that I was saying to them because I had to be what I was saying. You know, my model had to be that inside of the jail. You know, when we stepped out of this room and going back into, you know, the jail system, you know, you have to be that. And them guys looked at you real close, you know, and they draw closer to you because they felt a sense of protection that everybody looked for when you go in there. You know, even the strongest guys, like when I talk about Little Melvin, you know, Sim Charles, Stakem and stuff like that, you know, even the guys from The Wire, they're my closest friends, Chris Warren and all of them, Bodie, all of them, they're my closest friends. These are guys I come up with, you know, even us. We cry, you know, we feel a sense of abandonment, you know, we feel like, you know, we left alone and there's nobody there for us, you know, so you have to, you know, pull yourself together and you have to make a serious decision. Now, I didn't make this decision when I first went in there, you know, I still had a street mentality. It was, to me, it was kill or be killed, you know, do what you had to do. You have to be there first. You know, find out, you know, how do I deal with this world in here? How do I deal with all these ills that I heard about what's going on in here? You know what I mean? And again, I seen guys trick dudes out of their butt. I seen dudes trick, and some of them was the best of friends. You know, I even seen a dude, I heard a dude, and he was talking about, paying off his bill. He said he had another court to go through. He had already had a 30-year sentence. It was a white guy. And he said he don't think he can handle another, you know, some more time. And it was a commissary day. And everybody was going up to the chow when he was coming back from commissary. He said, I'm going to pay all y'all off that I owe y'all. He said, y'all can take this right here. He said, the rest of y'all, when y'all come back, it'll be in my cell. Now, his cell was next door to me. And again, I worked in an MCI shop, so that's the best job you can get in the system. I came down to go to commissary just to put my stuff in my cell and then go back to work. So I didn't go to chow that day. So I heard something, and I had made my salat because my prayer came in. But I heard something kicking on the wall real hard. kicking on the wall real, real hard and stuff. I knocked on the wall, right? And I said, boy, you all right over there? And it wouldn't, never said nothing. So when they came back from chow, he had hung himself. He had hung himself. You open up all the doors when you come back from chow, but you got to get in yourself. And I stepped out there to look at him and make sure he was all right, but he had hung himself. You know, and it messed me up real bad, you know, because that wasn't the first hanging I saw. But he was actually a good dude, you know. I mean, we made mistakes, stuff like that, you know, but he was actually a good dude. You know, that wasn't the only hanging I saw. I saw a lot. You know, being in prison for 30 years, you see a lot. I'm going to give you two, and I'm going to try to make it as brief as possible. I'm going to give you two of the experiences that I saw. I'm going to give you three, and I'm going to make them real brief. Young guy, younger than me at the time, I had grown a little older then. I probably was in my mid-20s, maybe late-20s, was on the phone talking to his young lady, telling her that, you know, don't leave, hold on. You know, I got a kid, but you say I'm going back to court. He said, and the judge talking about taking most of my time back. That means I would only have to do a year. You can hear him because he's talking real loud. And at this time, they had put phones on the tears. And he was talking real loud and stuff like that. And he was like, don't leave me. And started crying and stuff like that. And the officer, you know, told him he had to hold it down because he was loud and talking to his girl. So she must have hung up on him because kept saying, is you dead? You dead? You dead? And he tried to call back, and she wouldn't accept the call. He asked the officer to let him lock in and stuff. And he went and locked in. And about a half an hour, maybe to an hour later, you know, the tier he was on was a traffic tier. And what that means, you had to come through his tier to get to other tiers, you know. And one of his friends, was coming up this, through the tier to go to his cell. I mean, to go to his tier, looked in his cell, and he had hung himself. He was hanging from the bars, and when the officer opened up the grill, everybody ran down to his cell, you know, and they were telling the officer, open the door so we can grab and try to put him up to see if he was still living. Mm-hmm. But the officer, you can't do that. You got to leave the scene exactly the way it is, you know. And the officer wouldn't open the door. He wouldn't even go in there and do it until the warden came up and nurses from the infirmary came up. So we felt that sense of betrayal, you know, knowing that the system didn't have our best interests at heart. When gangs started getting popular in the jail, this guy, he, you know, his family was real supportive of him. So, and we get packages. We had package months and all that type of stuff. You know, and this guy, he would take certain guys and say, go, let me get a package in your name that wasn't getting packaged. He said, I'll get my mother to buy you a couple pair of jeans and I'll get my mother to buy you some tennis, you know, because he wanted to get it, you know, have a lot of clothes. Mm-hmm. So this particular dude, I knew the dude too, come out of Lexington Terrace. You know, he was in the game, Black Gorilla, whatever they call him. What's the name?
Family.
Exactly.
BFG, Black Gorilla Family.
That's right. Exactly. Mm-hmm. And they went to him to lean on him and tell him to go get us some of this. And he told me, he said, man, you must be crazy. I'm not getting you anything. He said, all right. So I'm not, you know, scared of that. So we went in the yard that evening. And in jail, you can tell when something can happen because you feel that all around you, so you know it. You know, you feel that vibe going around you, and everybody back is to the wall. You know, so I walk out in the yard, and one of the guys say, you know, I used to like to run the yard. He used to say, Basim, hold on, man. He said, something great happened. And lo and behold, while I can turn around, you can hear a bat cracking. The dude hit the dude with the bat in the head and cracked his skull. Mm-hmm. He died. They sent in an ambulance to lift him up out of there, but the guy died. We had to go in this place called the Annex, so they moved a lot of us off the tier because off of certain tiers because asbestos was all through the tier, and the fungus and stuff was falling up the wall. So while they was working on it and closed down the tier, they sent us in this place called the Annex. It's like a dorm. Mm-hmm. You got three parts to this dorm, you know, so we had one tier in this dorm, one tier in that dorm, one tier, and you can interact with each other and stuff like that. This guy that I know that come out of Murphy Holmes, and another guy that came out of another part of Murphy Holmes, was there. And the older guy, and the guy was real small. He was leaning on the younger guy. He was always take his commissary, always go through his packets and stuff like that. And the younger guy would always report to the officers what the guy was doing. And he wanted to be moved from the tier or moved out of jail. And they would just discount it and throw it away and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So when they moved us down in the annex, and they had a gym period, and a guy told him, and it was a commissary day, and he told me, he said, when I come back, excuse my language, he said, my commissary shit better be on my bed. The young guy said, I'm tired of this, man. I'm not going to allow you to do this to me anymore. This is the last time. I'm not doing this. I'm not doing it. So on the way, when they came back from gym, we get like an hour and maybe 20 minutes to a half an hour in gym. You know, when they came back from gym, he come in there, he called himself being bad, he walked straight to the young guy. And the young guy pulled out an ice pick and stuck him right in his chest. And he left it in his chest. And the dude grabbed his chest and turned around. And what you call, what we got, where officers sit up in the station, we call it the bubble. He tried to walk to the bubble, and before he got to the bubble, he fell. And that's where he died. You know, so, you know, a lot of stuff in prison, yeah, you see. It's like a lot of yes infection. And you have to you have to mold your life around that, because you don't never know when it's gonna be someone to challenge you. One thing my mother told me when she put me out, right? She used to always, you know, still be there for me, but she told me, don't you ever think you bad, because there's someone badder than you. And they will always challenge you because they wanna be the most bad one. She said, but always be serious and a man of your word. And I stuck with that. It stuck with me to the day. I'm a serious brother, and I take things real serious. And I try to be a man of my word. And if things change, I go to the person and say, look, I have to do something else. This is what happened. Now, can you bear with me? Or let's just, you know, resolve the issue. You know, and I remember that, and it makes me a better man. Having a strike against you, you know, it always fall in a place where opportunities are lacking, and you are not, you know, given the, you know, the best of the choices that come a person's way. But you have to realize that you put yourself in this position, and you have to make something happen for yourself. You know, society, to me, in a lot of ways, haven't gotten better. It got some ways worse than it was when I went into society because, you know, you did, like, you know, Brother Greg said, you had a more conscious out here on the streets when I went in. You know, men would be men, and they would stick, you know, they lived it by principles and standards and stuff like that. You know, today, youth doesn't live by certain standards or morals and stuff like that. Even when you go into going into a company or a corporation and trying to get a job, you know, when I first came home, I went to this welding company, and my credentials was better than the guy that was before me and after me. And when I went into an interview, she asked me, was I ever incarcerated. I started to lie because I know there's a window that you have from 5 to 7 years that they can ask you about your incarceration or put on your application. And I didn't put it on there. And when she went down the application, she asked me, you know, was you ever incarcerated? And I paused. And I was asking myself in my mind, you know, should I tell her the truth or should I lie? You know, and I said, I'm going to tell her the truth because this would be the best way of me getting something, you know, with my belief in God and everything and stuff like that. So I told her, I said, yes, I was incarcerated before. I said, but it had been a long time ago. It was a while ago. I said, it was back in 1985. I said, I haven't been to prison since then. And then she said, would you mind expounding on what you was incarcerated for? And I kind of knew then, right then and there, that I was going to be a scratch from this list. Right. And I said, is that a requirement? Do I have to do it? She said, no, you don't have to do it. She said, but, I prefer you do it. Okay. I said, I was young. I said, I come out of, a drug ridden area. Some of us would call it probably ghetto and things of that nature. I said, but it was, an area where you grew up and you had to make certain choices. I said, when I was young, I made the wrong choice. I said, I got in a situation where, some guys kind of tried to rob me. And I had a gun on me. And I shot one of the guys and he died. And she said, all right, I don't need to hear no more. But I knew right then and there that society wasn't going to play fair with me, you know, and that I would have to make my own way. But I had to understand, too, on the other side of that coin, no one did this to me but me, you know. So I had to find somewhere to keep trying to put this bitterness that I had with society about me being in incarceration in a place where it wouldn't affect me of doing what I needed to be done, you know. So, yeah, no, I think society plays for me. And sometimes it does. Yes, I appreciate that. I appreciate that, Anna. And you know, it was a blessing to me. You know, and just to piggyback from what you said, right, in terms of strength, a lot of people say to me, right, Fasim, that's my Muslim man. They say, Fasim, tell me the truth. You did 30 years straight. I say, yeah. They say, man, you're not demented. You're not crazy. Nothing like that stuff. I said, I'm blessed by God. I say, so if you call that crazy, then I'm crazy. I said, but no, I'm not crazy. Do I have my moments of psychological effects? I said, yeah, I had them. I said, but everybody has them. You know, I said, but I'm not crazy. I trusted God while I was there, and God brought me through. But when I went to prison, you know, I had a prison experience where I went to a Christian meeting, and they was talking about other religious groups on how, you know, if you don't accept Christ, you're going to hell, and you and they this and they that, you know, some of them are nationalists and all. Now, I said to them, this is before I caught my 50-year sentence. I say, why are we talking about other groups? Let's talk about what God can do for us. Because I'm scared because I went in there. My papers, they give you a true bill when you have a murder. Had first degree on there, murder. You don't get the rest of the degrees until you go into court. You know, like first degree, second degree manslaughter, something like that, or not guilty. You know, so I said, why does we keep talking about these people? Let's talk about what God going to do for us and what we need to do to change. I don't want to hear that in the outside coordinating the, and the head of the group say, well, if you don't want to hear this, you can leave, right? And I left, and I had already knew two older guys that was in Islam. Asked me, well, I thought you was at your meeting. I said, nah, I just went through something, you know, stuff like that. So they said, well, you're welcome to come to a Talim service, which is a speaking gathering when you go to the Muslim thing. And it made me open my heart to look at other religions. And I seen Islam. I found Islam was the best thing for me. You know, it opened my mind. You know, it gave me a different perspective about people and the world, you know. And it just went from there, you know, just went from there. But I try not to push it on other people because they are who they are, regardless of what it is. You know, I just, you know, leave it to me. And when somebody asks me, then I explain it to them. I would love to do this again whenever you need me. I would love to give back because there's so much to what I have to say in terms of me, that transition from being my first incarceration into my second, you know, and yes, the things that affected me in terms of my second incarceration. So I would love to do this again because I feel like I'm giving back.